In a culture given to blurbs and quick takes, it's hard to get a handle on Ferruccio Busoni. Composer, conductor, transcriber, pianist, writer, bibliophile, graphic artist, thinker, teacher, classicist, modernist. He died in 1924, and we're still trying to figure him out.
Busoni said about himself, "I think too much."
Pianist Garrick Olson is currently steeped in Busoni's music in preparation for a three-part recital series at Lincoln Center.
He was a very contemplative and brilliant man of astounding creativity.
The astounding creativity of Ferruccio Busoni has only recently come to light, or let's just say it has recently been of interest. He is a confoundingly big subject, with his broad intellectual interests and gifts, stunning visionary ideas, and totally unpredictable, variable music, which may be why his legacy still seems a bit fuzzy.
When you see Busoni's name on a piece, you don't know exactly what language you're getting. The public doesn't know what to expect. Busoni sits between many worlds.
Busoni was the product of a German mother and an Italian father.
So he felt very much at home in both worlds and not totally at home in either. He never quite settled at home anywhere.
In music, he was similarly unsettled.
He went from the era of Liszt and Brahms till the past the outbreak of World War I, when European music sort of blew apart. I mean, he knew Schoenberg, he knew the works of Bartok and all these people, so he really spanned an enormous era.
What was the effect of living across these decades and generations and cultures? Well, one effect was that he wrote music that sounded like this. And also music that sounded like this. Early Brahms, naturally, sounded different from late Brahms, for example, and many composers embraced different styles, but with Busoni, it was just a little more intensely different. And then, of course, there are those Bach transcriptions to confuse everyone. Busoni loved to take Bach pieces written for the organ or the violin or harpsichord and make piano versions of them and expand on them and sometimes reconfigure them for piano. And they've tended to overshadow his own work.
You know, his wife was often called Mrs. Bach Busoni when he was making these transcriptions because they became so incredibly popular. It was a time, of course, when people were popularizing Bach, who was relatively unknown. By the late 19th century, Bach was still not the sort of mainstreamer for the public that we consider him now.
Busoni mainstreamed Bach, if you will. And then there were those gifts as a performing pianist.
Busoni in his time was the way Glenn Gould was in ours. He was an iconoclast and a modernist. He was reviving older repertoire and playing it in a way that no one had or would.
Alan Evans, a scholar of early recordings and a record producer, has just remastered and re-released All We Have of Busoni's famously revelatory piano playing, roughly 30 minutes of music by Bach, Beethoven, Chopin, and Liszt, recorded in 1922.
What we have of his piano playing is such a brief glimpse, a mere glimpse. The Liszt and the Bach are the best examples.
He was, without a doubt, by everybody who heard him and wrote about him and spoke about him, you know, one of the greatest pianists of all time. Certainly a candidate for maybe even the number one spot along with Liszt, I don't know. He was a virtuoso of virtually limitless possibility on the keyboard.
There's the ending of the Liszt 13th Rhapsody, where it's the earthiest gypsy playing imaginable. Whereas when most people would play a Hungarian Rhapsody, the last part would allude to gypsies. And he plays it as a gypsy, however, by rushing the phrases the way a gypsy violinist would hurry the endings. The exact same touch and elan to it. No one has done that.
And there is Busoni's one Bach recording.
You feel like you're listening to a wise man. It's just extraordinary. There is an incredible serenity to the playing.
Pianist Marc-André Hamelin fell for Busoni's Bach playing years ago and later became captivated by his rather crazily long, ambitious piano concerto, which Hamlin heard on an old recording.
Keep in mind that the piano doesn't come in for about 4 minutes or so. And almost from the very first, I thought, my God, this is absolutely gorgeous. Why isn't this played? A little bit later, when I got the score, I pretty much answered my own question. because I realized how thick and how unwieldy much of the piano writing was.
In the final movement, a chorus, which has been waiting for over an hour to perform, joins in.
Yeah, it's not quite comfortable for most singers, I would say. For many people, he might not be audience-friendly. I think one has to be prepared for something different.
You can hear how he broods a lot. It shows these chiaroscuro shadings, these dark, brooding basses. He loved emphasizing the bass regions.
He was a brooder, all right, and a dreamer. It's hard to think of another composer whose interests were so varied and whose thinking was so independent. Though he lived well into the era in which Schoenberg and others sought to abandon the old for the new, Busoni had other ideas. He wrote of his high ideals for art, young classicism, he called what he was aiming for, an art, he wrote, that will be old and new at the same time. In a way, he did that, and it's been a lot for audiences and even musicians to take in. I think too much, he said, but as we think about where music is going, it might do us well to listen. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fischko.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.